President Trump is in England, a country he described as being in turmoil over Brexit. He called it a hotspot. It is the second leg of his European trip that includes next Monday's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. The president talked about Putin during a wide-ranging press conference before he left the NATO summit in Brussels earlier today.
I hope we get along well. I think we get along well. But ultimately, he's a competitor. He's representing Russia. I'm representing the United States. So in a sense, we're competitors, not a question of friend or enemy. He's not my enemy.
The president was also asked about Brexit after two of the British Prime Minister's cabinet secretaries resigned this week over objections to her plans for carrying it out.
The people voted to break it up. So I would imagine that's what they'll do. But maybe they're taking a little bit of a different route. So I don't know if that's what they voted for.
Let's start there with BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, as the president arrives, where does Brexit stand today?
Do you know what? I mean, although the British government wouldn't thank the president for saying it, you know, when he used those words, hotspot and turmoil, I think he was pretty much spot on. I mean, I think there is a huge political crisis brewing here over Brexit. Of course, it's been going on ever since the vote to leave. But to bring you right up to speed, essentially, the British government, the governing Conservative Party, has been very deeply divided on what Britain's future relationship with the European Union should be. There are some in the party who campaign for Brexit, who wanted to be a very distant relationship, those who think that would be economic madness and who want to be much closer. Now, finally, after 2 years of sort of dithering and standing on the fence, Theresa May has come down on the much sort of softer, closer side of the argument, and now it's just published its plan for what that future relationship with the European Union should be in more detail. But the problem is, of course, and you could probably kind of see this one coming, is that you've got people saying, hang on a minute, we're not close enough to the European Union, and others who are saying we're far too close. So the government's in that danger of not pleasing either side.
And is Prime Minister May in danger of losing her job because of the way she's handling this?
I think a challenge is certainly possible. I think the only thing that stops that is in her governing Conservative Party. They can't agree on who should replace her and what that person who should replace her would do. I mean, the Conservative Party is still divided over whether Britain should stay closer to the European Union, as Theresa May has plumped for, or should have a much more distant relationship. But the problem is, if you look at the maths of our parliamentary makeup, I mean, there just isn't a majority there for that kind of distant, pure, hard line, whatever kind of adjective you like to call it, Brexit, that those who campaign for it would like.
Now, the president's visit to the UK, this has been talked about for a long time. There were questions about whether it would actually happen. It obviously is happening. But there are protests, and he was asked about those protests today. Let's listen.
I think it's fine. I mean, I think they like me a lot in the UK. I think they agree with me on immigration.
In fact, the protesters, it sounds like, don't like his immigration policies, especially detention at the border. How would you characterize public opinion about President Trump in the UK right now?
Well, handily, I had seen a public opinion poll by a company called YouGov, I think, and amazingly, I think President Trump is only just behind President Putin as the least liked foreign leader, and the disapproval rating is really crazy high. I think it's way above 70%, so you've got more than two-thirds of the UK population thinking that he's not a great thing at all. So I think while the president might have said that he's liked in the UK, and while maybe it's true that people do have concerns about immigration, I think he's definitely going to get a pretty rough reception. Not, of course, that he's going to see any of that stuff, because he'll be travelling around by helicopter as opposed to walking through the centre of London.
Do you think it's likely that he and Prime Minister May will come out with some trade deal, some free trade deal between the US and the UK during this visit?
I don't, actually. I don't think very much of substance will come from this at all. I mean, partly it's just a question of time. They're not spending that much time together. But I think more importantly than that, I think the United States, it seems to me, is very unlikely to want to conclude a trade deal with the UK until it knows exactly what Britain's future relationship with the European Union were going to be. I mean, an awful lot of American companies and banks, they like being based in the UK because it's a gateway to Europe. So I think the US will want to know that. The other thing I think that prevents much of substance happening is stems from what Donald Trump said, what the president said. He said this is a country in turmoil. I mean, would the US administration really want to make concessions and do deals with a leader and a government that it might worry about might not be here in a couple of months' time?
Rob, what is President Trump's meeting with the Queen going to be like?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I don't know whether as a reporter you're allowed to kind of offer money to the Queen to be a guest.
Right.
Do you know, the funny thing is I have a friend who is a diplomat, one of my contacts, who has actually had the Queen make tea for him. But based on what I heard from that contact of mine, I would say that whatever comes the Queen's way, whether it's Donald Trump, whoever it is, whether it was Vladimir Putin, I mean, goodness knows, whether it was me, whether it was you, whether it was anyone listening, I'm sure they'd have a thoroughly lovely cuppa. And I'm told that she pours it. I am told that she pours it herself.
I'm sure she does. And I hear that she, when you meet her, she knows, you know, everything about everything that you're talking about. She's very knowledgeable.
That's what we hear. And that she's also got an absolutely cracking sense of humor. Some people might say she's going to need it.
That's BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, back at home, Peter Strzok is before Congress today, and it's not pretty. He's the FBI agent whose anti-Trump text to a female friend during the presidential election brought howls from Trump supporters when the texts were revealed. He was involved in the Bureau's investigations into Hillary Clinton's emails and Russian meddling in the 2016 election. In his opening statement before the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees, Strzok questioned the purpose of the meeting.
I have the utmost respect for Congress's oversight role, but I strongly believe today's hearing is just another victory notch in Putin's belt and another milestone in our enemy's campaign to tear America apart.
Well, NPR political reporter Tim Mak is here. Hi, Tim. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
Hi there. And as you know, things got off to a remarkably unruly start. The Democrats objecting to Oversight Committee Chair Goodlatte's handling of the event. He is responding to Democrat Jerry Nadler.
Are you just going to make up rules as we go along?
Is that the motion is not in order during the time controlled by the gentleman from South Carolina.
I appeal that ruling of the chair.
Mr. Strzok, will
Mr.
you
Chairman,
answer?
I appeal your ruling of the chair that my motion to adjourn is not in order.
The gentleman is not in order.
Tim Mak, a lot of this had to do with parliamentary rules. Explain.
So the hearing kind of erupted in a back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats seemed really eager to stall and gum up the works. The whole hearing has to do with, look, was there a sense of bias that motivated the original investigation into the Trump campaign and alleged collusion or coordination with Russia? Republicans have said, I think, you know, this poisons the well a little bit. But Democrats don't see it that way.
Well, Peter Strzok himself said he leaves his personal beliefs at the door when he walks into the FBI. His personal text never crossed over into the realm of action, that he wasn't removed from an investigation, which he was by Robert Mueller, because of bias, but to avoid the appearance of bias. But remind us, you know, what he said in the text and how much ire his name has drawn.
Well, in the text, basically, he says various things that are disparaging about the president. He says various things that are disparaging about Trump supporters. And he also says, quote, that he'll stop the president,
that
the then-candidate Trump.
We will stop the president, right. Yeah.
That they'll stop the then-candidate Trump from being elected president. Now, was he referring to the FBI? Was he referring to his own work? Or was he referring to American voters in general? He's argued that he was talking about American voters in general. But as for the ire, he's certainly drawn the attention of now President Trump, who has been tweeting like crazy about basically, you know, the whole Strzok controversy. And he's called it, and the bias that is apparent in some of these texts, part of the witch hunt that's out to get him on the Russia issue.
Well, just tell us some of the questions that he's fielding from both Republicans and Democrats. What's you know, the tone?
Yeah, well, Republicans are eager to try to show that he was biased and that this bias may have tainted the origins of the investigation into potential Trump-Russia collusion. On the other hand, Democrats are trying to make the point that as a private individual, as an American citizen, Strzok had every right to have personal, private, political opinions, which he expressed, and that he was able to, like any FBI agent would be able to, or like any American citizen would be able to, leave those opinions at the door when he came to work.
Yeah. Look, on the face of them, the texts were pretty appalling. A friend saying, is Trump going to win? And Strzok responding, we'll stop him. And as you say, he's been saying that he meant the American people, the voters. But could this have an effect on the Russia investigation, this hearing and what we're hearing?
I think this hearing is part of a larger issue, which is when Special Counsel Mueller comes out with his conclusions from his investigation, will it have legitimacy? I think supporters of the president are hoping to undercut some of the legitimacy of the ongoing investigation. When Mueller has things to say, he's been very quiet until now, will Republicans be able to undercut his conclusions?
NPR political reporter Tim Mak. As the hearings continue in Washington. Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
To North Carolina now, where they're harvesting tobacco, which brings in just under $725 million a year, the biggest crop in the state. It's all hands on deck, even small ones. Now, the Labor Standards Act makes exceptions for child laborers on small family farms, and even larger farms can hire kids as young as 12. But child advocates say migrant children as young as 7 are working from dawn to dusk, sometimes with parents, sometimes without. Melissa Bailey Castillo is with the Kinston Community Health Center in Kinston, North Carolina, the only health center in the heart of tobacco country there. She's at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about what the work entails.
It is definitely dangerous. There's a lot of spraying going on from the time you plant until the time you harvest. Right now, the crop is getting ready to top, which is where you cut the flower mm-hmm. off the top, or you also take the bottom leaves off the bottom. Once the tobacco plant gets to be about, 3 or 4 feet tall, it's taller than a lot of the children out there. You know, here in North Carolina, we had a heat index of 109, which, would probably make it closer to 115, 117 degrees inside the field. Mm. It's kind of a legacy in eastern North Carolina. Either your neighbor owns a farm or a relative owns a farm. Tobacco, obviously, is part of that heritage. And, kids have been working in it. Farmers will tell you for generations they worked in it.
But this happens in different communities across the country. Up in Aroostook, Maine, kids get 3 weeks off from school to go pick potatoes.
Right.
But we're talking about migrant workers here largely. And with the crop, this is tobacco.
Right. One of the hardest things that we've had to do is convince growers and even, American Farm Bureau that these children don't have a connection to the farmer or the farmer's family. They're essentially picked up, dropped off at a field, and told to work. Mm. If the tobacco makes them sick, or at whatever point the tobacco does make them sick, there's no one looking out for them.
And let's talk about how they might get sick. This is nicotine poisoning.
It is. Yeah. It is. Green tobacco sickness is nicotine poisoning. It's hard to work with gloves in this crop because you tend to tear the leaves and the farmer doesn't like that. It's also, the gloves you put on, the leaves will start to stick to the glove. So you're barehanded. A lot of times you're barefooted because of the roots and the mud. And by midday, their hands are covered in tar. Maybe they've taken off their shirt. Maybe they didn't know how to dress to begin with, so they've gone in short sleeves instead of long sleeves. In any case, this nicotine is absorbed through the skin. Yeah. It's not unusual that by lunchtime, you're throwing up, you're vomiting. Regulations say, a hand washing station in a bathroom, et cetera, but that's not the reality in the field. Some of the larger operations, they will have that. A lot of operations do not have that.
Young workers talk about having to eat their lunch without washing their hands of that nicotine. And as you said, getting, you know, the nausea, rashes, headaches, and they show up in your clinics or not, because there are camps in Kinston, trailer parks filled with trailers filled with migrant workers, 30 to 40 maybe, with children sharing a bathroom. So even if they go home, they might not get to wash it off.
Right. In the state of North Carolina, you know, if they have a 5-gallon bucket and access to a water hose, there's nothing specifically that says they have to have, like, a washer and dryer, for example. There's nothing that says they have to have an air conditioner either. In this heat, your body can't cool off. If you're an adolescent or younger, then you're in even more danger. It's just a seriously bad crop to try to work in.
But according to the reporting in The Atlantic, often the farmers don't think they have child workers.
Right. Yeah, so first of all, the children that show up in the clinic, maybe they'll say they ate something bad or, you know, in any case, you don't have child workers walking through the door saying, oh, I worked in tobacco and now I'm sick. They may look at a parent like, what do I say? Or the parent will be like, no, they weren't working out of fear. And they've been warned, you can't tell anybody that your child's working because you could get in trouble. Your child could be taken from you, none of which is true. So there is a certain sense of, you know, we have to hide this. And then obviously after a lot of the work that's been done by Human Rights Watch and CField, they know now that there's some controversy.
Well, but we should say, you know, often workers show up, they're paid in cash, they don't have to give any ID. I mean, this is the way that they are invisible. Talk about the regulations. We know that there was an attempt by the Obama administration to put working with tobacco and working with power-driven equipment into the category of hazardous work that can't be done by anyone under 16. But this is where the farm lobbying groups really push back. They make the complaint, well, that means that family farms can't operate.
Right. The reality on the ground looks a lot different. On the ground, these children were employed by contractors. They were not being protected. They were not being paid appropriately. They were being paid in cash. Once we put some pressure on growers and warned them about contractors who weren't paying children appropriately, and, you know, we started really communicating that, American Farm Bureau, they want to tell one story, and that story is families work on farms, and if you do anything to impact a child's right to learn how to farm, then you're destroying the American farm. However, that on the ground in eastern North Carolina could not be further from the truth. First of all, the farms impacted most by child farm workers, they were enormous operations, corporate farms. It was not a matter of the Smiths down the road employing children through a contractor. That was rare, if at all. So it becomes very difficult when you're trying to change labor laws and you have a voice as loud, as prominent, as strong as American Farm Bureau. It shuts down the real conversation. And the real conversation is that in the state of North Carolina, contractors, they have no guidelines. There are no laws. There are no policies. The only thing that these contractors have to do is register as labor contractors through the Federal Department of Labor.
The American Farm Bureau Federation, the AFBF, the largest farm industry group in the country, responded to some of this in 2012, again, when the Obama administration was trying to institute some regulations. And their leader at the time said, we have no desire to have young teenagers working in jobs that are inappropriate, but laws need to be sensible, not prohibiting teens from performing simple everyday farm functions like operating a battery-powered screwdriver, which, of course, wasn't the intent of the regulations. It was to keep kids out of truly dangerous situations like tobacco picking. And then the Obama administration did make some changes to EPA regulations in 2015. One is a ban on children under 18 from handling pesticides or reentering fields where pesticides have been recently sprayed. And we, as we mentioned, tobacco fields are often wet with spray. The second, a rule that bans children from working with restricted-use pesticides. But now the Trump administration, backed by the AFBF, is trying to roll back those regulations.
Right. And I think the bigger question here is why. What runs through our heads as advocates and as community health center who, you know, has seen firsthand what green tobacco sickness looks like. Why? What possible motivation could you have for rolling that back? Demanding the continued presence of children this age in a field essentially under the responsibility of a labor contractor who has absolutely no accountability at all.
Well, could one answer be that who else is going to do it?
I think these children live in our communities. We educate them. They are a part of the fabric of rural communities now. I mean,
and I don't mean that, by the way, as then they should do it. But I'm suspecting that these farmers are. This is hard, dangerous, unhealthy work. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find people to do this work.
Yeah, you know, and we have growers, both large and medium-sized and small, sending for H-2A visa workers. They don't track who overstays their visa. It just seems to make more sense to go ahead and acknowledge the workforce, give them some work protections and work permissions, and stop sending for more workers, and then you're not even tracking who's coming and going. And I just am very disappointed in Farm Bureau for not, you know, acknowledging that you literally have a couple of different labor forces here. You have the family farm. Yes, it still exists, alive and well. You have some small growers who have teenagers working with them, but they take them to the seed cell and they teach them about farming. And they think of these children as an extension of their own family. We have that. And those children, you know, are Hispanic. And then we have, unfortunately, contractors and corporate farms with thousands of acres where these children are in danger. And those are the children that need to be protected. And there aren't a few.
How many would you say?
You know, the last summer that I was out doing a count, I stopped at 100 kids in two counties. That's just who I found. I have no idea.
That's Melissa Bailey Castillo, Director of Community Outreach at the Kinston Community Health Center in Kinston, North Carolina, advocating for more regulations around child labor, especially in the tobacco picking industry. This is the season. Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We reached out to the American Farm Bureau for a response. They say they neither promote nor condone any illegal practices, and they urge workers and advocates to speak up for anyone who's been, quote, authentically wronged. Their full statement will be at our website, hereandnow.org. And after nearly a month of kicking a ball around, the World Cup final is set. France will play Croatia on Sunday in Moscow. And to get there, the French beat Belgium. Croatia beat England with Mario Mandzukic's extra time goal. So we were treated to this on Telemundo.
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
I don't understand why Andreas Cantor was underselling that goal. It was so subtle.
Now, I was sort of hoping for the Channel edition of the World Cup final in England-France situation. Yeah. But yeah. This will be interesting as well. Croatia, first ever World Cup final. France won its only World Cup title in 1998. How do you like this matchup?
Well, first of all, I consider that England-France edition the 100 Years War edition, just okay, so you know. Okay. Channel is looking on the bright side. Croatia made the semifinals in the year that France won the World Cup. In fact, they were knocked out by France in 98. Croatia is a much smaller country.
Size of New York City. Okay,
yeah, 4.5 million people, one of the smallest countries in the World Cup. But they're a really good team, or a quality side, as the football people might say. They just, in terms of personnel, do not stack up with the French, though that is probably also true for England. If you want to talk about who is making big contracts and who would be considered the better players, England was more stocked, but Croatia played them tight enough to get to overtime and eventually win. All that said, the odds makers are saying that France is about a 5-2 favorite, which means 2.5 times the team that Croatia is. And that seems about right to me.
Well, but, you know, what? Just talk about the tournament itself. I mean, playing out while there's a young soccer team stuck in a cave in Thailand and all these superstars from football were, you know, sending wishes to them. I thought it was a great, has been a great World Cup. What do you think?
Yes, without horrible incidents, other than the original sin of the World Cup, which is to have these white elephant type sporting events that cost the host country money. The football, the soccer has been great. So many close games, and we got especially big moments from Ronaldo early on, and we've seen new stars. Mbappe on France seems like a phenomenal new player. So we've seen a bunch of new stars in the making. The only thing I would say to disturb the silver lining is that there's always one surprise team of the tournament, and Croatia maybe is it. But if you look at the FIFA rankings, Croatia is great. The one that was really far down in the rankings who had a sort of miracle run is the host country, the Russian team. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get behind the Russians, just given geopolitics and the head of state and hacking in the election and things like that.
I'll tell you, our executive producer, Kathleen McKenna, who is married to a Belgian, was very unhappy about the result of Belgium and France.
Yes.
Yes, but Belgium played well. And I mean, I think they've really shown themselves
that does
to
not
be
matter.
A soccer powerhouse. Nope.
Okay,
last game matters.
Listen, we only have a few seconds, but we're going to have you back to talk about Major League Baseball because they hit the All-Star break after this weekend. And we want to have your thoughts on that. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, also editor of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. What if Croatia went to the finals in the World Cup? We're going to find out.
This is
That'll
here and now.
Paperback.
Yesterday, we started a conversation about one of the most powerful men in America, the Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. We talked with Paul Kane of The Washington Post about McConnell's rise to leadership in Congress, where Republicans gained a majority in both houses in 2014. In 2016, McConnell successfully blocked Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick to fill a Supreme Court vacancy, from getting a hearing. He argued that Congress shouldn't confirm a nominee in a presidential election year. Here he is bragging about it at a political event in Kentucky.
One of my proudest moments is when I looked at Barack Obama in the eye and I said, Mr. President, you will not fill this Supreme Court vacancy.
McConnell then got Trump's nominee, Neil Gorsuch, through by ending the Senate filibuster on Supreme Court nominations, which allowed Republicans to confirm a nominee with a simple majority instead of 60 votes. I asked Paul Kane if McConnell had any misgivings about making such a significant change to Senate rules.
No. You look again, his autobiography is called The Long Game, and he's used that phrase, one of the proudest moments, over and over again. He basically looked at that decision to block the Garland seat and then ultimately filling it with Neil Gorsuch as the defining moment of his career that he did for the conservative movement writ large. And he felt that the open seat that there was there on the Supreme Court throughout the fall of 2016 helped drive out conservative turnout for Senate Republicans and probably helped elect Donald Trump president, which then led to the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. And at that point, McConnell was going to do whatever it took to complete this three-part act. And he basically looked back at 2013 and that Harry Reid and Democrats had unilaterally changed the rules for all judicial nominations except for Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And once he had all Republicans pretty much on board, he felt like it was an easy move to change the rules. And you had from Cruz to Collins, Ted Cruz to Susan Collins, supported Gorsuch. And that's the entire wingspan of the ideological divide in that caucus. He felt like he could do it, and he just went ahead and rammed it through and confirmed Gorsuch on a simple majority vote.
What about Mitch McConnell's relationship with President Trump? He has sparred with the president at times. Here's an example of a not-so-subtle dig against the president's position on the status of DACA recipients.
I'm looking for something that President Trump supports, and he's not yet indicated what measure he's willing to sign. As soon as we figure out what he is for, then I would be convinced that we were not just spinning our wheels going to this issue on the floor, but actually dealing with a bill that has a chance to become law and therefore solve the problem.
What do you think of Mitch McConnell's relationship with President Trump?
The relationship is built almost entirely on winning or losing. When they're winning, as they were in the spring of 2017 with the confirmation of Gorsuch, the relationship was great. At that same time, Paul Ryan and House Republicans were struggling to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and that relationship was terrible. And Trump was both saying things publicly and tweeting bad things about Ryan. Later in the summer, after the House Republicans did actually pass a bill repealing Obamacare, the Senate failed in 2017. And that led to that sparring, Jeremy, that you're referencing throughout August of 2017. Trump was both tweeting and saying things about McConnell, about he was weak, that he couldn't get things done. But then in the fall, they put together massive tax cuts, $1.5 trillion and counting in tax cuts, and they got it through both the House and Senate relatively smoothly compared to the terrible rocky ride of trying to repeal the ACA. And that put the relationship back on a strong footing where, okay, we're winning now. We understand we're winning. And ever since then, they haven't been quite winning as much, and not on big legislation, but they're doing things that are slightly, slowly but surely advancing the conservative cause, and they feel like things that Trump can claim wins on, and therefore their relationship has been okay. They're never going to be personal friends. These are two people that are just diametrically different. You know, Trump is just all emotion and impulse, and McConnell is all entirely analysis and cerebral thought. You know, these two would not really enjoy dinner together, and especially over these like well-done burgers and steak that Trump would be getting, as McConnell is more prone to just sort of go to his local Mexican restaurant on Capitol Hill and have just quiet tacos. But their relationship for now has been working, and especially on Supreme Court matters, Trump seems to really trust McConnell. And, you know, he delivered that big win on Gorsuch, and so that helped make this process leading up to Kavanaugh much easier, much smoother because of that.
It's interesting, though, that even though Mitch McConnell has been so successful in getting the conservative agenda through, that there are a lot of Republicans, especially on the right, who really dislike him. And I want to listen here to this candidate in West Virginia who was running for Senate there on the Republican side. He didn't win, but listen to one of his ads that ran on television.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me.
I mean, there's so much there. This is Don Blankenship. He's saying China people, by the way. Mitch McConnell is married to Elaine Chao, who is currently the transportation secretary and is of Asian descent. But what about the political opposition from Republicans for Mitch McConnell?
McConnell, because of this incredibly laconic outward demeanor, has never been a favorite of conservatives, especially of this era's conservatives who view emotion as their chief ideological marker, anger, like just pure raw emotion. And that's what Trump really tapped into. McConnell is this completely withdrawn character who doesn't get very emotional, who doesn't talk loudly, who doesn't shout. And the conservatives have never trusted him because of that. And some of it is this ideological drift where he's moved in and out of issues. At one point in his early career, seemingly was pro-choice, or at least moderately pro-choice, and has moved into pro-life issues. So the conservatives have had this a little bit of a ideology issue and a lot of emotional restraint toward him. And it has made him this rare character in which the left cannot stand Mitch McConnell and believes that he is the most effective, conservative, ruthless, cheating conservative you could ever imagine. And then you have this far-right group who think that he's a rhino, that think that he's a squish and that he doesn't get enough done. These two visions of Mitch McConnell are competing all the time and clashing, and they are just so far apart that it is really one of the most unique things about him, especially when you compare him to like other congressional leaders, people like Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid, who by the time they had been around 6-8 years, they were loved by their base and just hated by right. everyone else.
And yet Mitch McConnell's been able to hold on to power all these years.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the Senate for McConnell's sake anyway. I mean, the Senate is very much a club. It's a unique club, and you have anywhere from 40 to 60 people who are your constituents, and McConnell has done a better job of maintaining his relationships with those Senate Republicans who hold the key to his job, mm-hmm. and they have always understood and respected him. They don't go to many dinners with him, and if they do, it's a quick fundraiser, and McConnell is in and out in about 15 minutes. But Mitch McConnell is the guy who raises money for them. Mitch McConnell takes all these bullets for them from the hard right and from the far left. And, you know, he doesn't seem to care or mind about that. And McConnell raises tons of money for the Senate Republicans. And so ultimately, they look at him, his fellow Republicans, and they think, well, nobody else can do this nearly as good as Mitch.
That's Paul Kane, who is senior congressional correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post. Paul, very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Jeremy.
And you can hear our full conversation about Mitch McConnell at hereandnow.org.
And it's Taco Thursday at
Finally.
Here Now. We've been waiting. Resident Chef Kathy Gunst is here in our brand new studios, so the entire engineering department is holding its breath. But we're going to be careful.
We're not going to spill.
You know, with these tacos, which make a great idea for a summer party. You can even have do your own.
Yeah, oh, totally. I mean, I did every element of this out on the grill last night and this morning. I heated the tortillas up. I cooked the pork. I cooked the fish. It's been so hot. So you want to start eating in a way where everything takes you outdoors.
Right.
So that's what we're going to talk about.
And we start with a very light fish taco.
A fish taco.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really lovely taco, super refreshing. You can use any type of fish that you like. This is a cod fillet. You could use swordfish, salmon, haddock. You could even use cooked lobster or crab. And I've made a fresh, kind of spicy mango salsa to go with it, which is super refreshing. And then what I call a lime cream, which is simply sour cream with grated lime zest and fresh lime juice.
That is a little bit spicy, but I was also going to say,
but
I love the taste of the mango there with the fish.
I know, juicy and summery and fresh. Mangoes are plentiful in the markets right now. I just wanted to tell you, this is a very odd little thing to say, but I just had the best taco of my life.
What?
My life. And you ready for this? Drum roll.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Detroit.
Wow. I'm not surprised.
You're not?
No.
I was.
Yeah.
I learned about this taco truck from Tostado magazine. There is a woman named Nancy Lopez. She is in Southwest Detroit, and she has El Parian, P-A-R-I-A-N, taco trucks. And it was insane. And I learned several things watching the guy making taco. And one of them leads us into the chicken taco, which is next. Here's the deal. I took a cast iron skillet and I put it on my hot, hot grill.
Okay.
You could do this indoors. I sprinkled grated Mexican cheese right into the skillet. Okay? Nothing's there. As soon as it melts and starts to, so you got a skillet
right.
and cheese. You with me?
Uh-huh.
You slap the tortilla on top of it, press it down, and 10 seconds later you flip it, and it's an instant melted cheese. It could be a quesadilla, but I used it as the base of a chicken and black bean taco.
It sticks to the tortilla that
quickly. Yes, it's like, I just watched this guy. I'm like, wait, what did he just do? That's so simple.
Wow.
There must be something I'm missing. But in fact, it truly is that simple. And you can do this indoors as well. Chicken, I use thighs with lime juice and cumin.
The lime juice, man.
Yes. So refreshing, right?
Yes.
It tastes like summer. So there's the melted cheese, there's this cumin and lime flavored grilled chicken, and then I just simmered black beans with onions and fresh cilantro and all kinds of flavors.
Now, the next one that you have here is one that is becoming one of my favorite kinds of tacos, which is an al pastor.
Al pastor. I call this tacos al pastor rápido because traditionally, so let's explain.
Yeah, what does it mean, right?
This is actually a kind of simplified fusion of a classic pork carnitas and a taco al pastor. And traditionally, the pork is marinated, which I did in chipotle peppers, fresh pineapple, onion, garlic, cumin, oregano. Mm-hmm. But then it's generally slow roasted for hours, like half a day. And given the heat of the last few weeks, there was no way I was turning my oven on. So I just chopped the pork up after it marinated for over 24 hours, threw it on a super hot grill, grilled fresh hunks of pineapple, mm-hmm. and then as soon as they were done, like 4 or 5 minutes on each side, took them off, let it cool, chopped it up, and then reheated it in a cast iron skillet on the grill till it got crispy and hot. So, Jeremy, you have the...
Well,
the
I had.
Had.
It's gone.
Oh, it's done. And
it's
Robin,
gone,
I gave
delicious.
You a pineapple
right,
version.
Right.
And I also wanted to talk about the fact that most of these I served on corn tortillas versus flour tortillas.
Yeah, they do fall apart a little more easily than a flour tortilla.
But you know what? They
but
have
sometimes
so
they
much
taste
more
better.
Flavor,
yeah.
as far as I'm concerned. You get that beautiful toasted corn flavor. Corn tortillas have been a staple in Mexican cuisine for literally thousands of years, and they're smaller, so you can eat more. Mm-hmm. And I always double them up. You'll notice there were two tortillas there. The reason you do that is that it holds together more, and you can only eat one or eat them both, and you could think of the second one as the plate.
Twice
your
the carbs.
Hand. Yeah, that's right. No, but it's the corn tortillas are a whole grain, okay? Whole grain. This is good.
I've been quiet over here because I just figured out that this was a grilled pineapple.
Isn't
and
that,
I'm eating it.
Right?
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
So what is the meat, really, of this taco is a grilled pineapple.
Absolutely. You can do a vegetarian version of any of these, but... As Jeremy just tasted, the pork is really tasty with that pineapple-y, pepper, cumin marinade. Now, flour tortillas are much more popular near our border. Flour sort of dominates breakfast tacos and burritos, and a lot of people like them. And then, of course, there are those taco shells, which are an Americanized version of the whole thing.
You mentioned that your favorite taco is in Detroit. I'm just reminded of when we did the show in Mexico City, we went to Enrique Olvera's place, Pujol, which was real. It's just all tacos. It was fantastic.
Name the truck in Detroit again.
It's called El Parian, P-A-R-I-A-N, and there are four of them, and it's
Salute.
This woman, Nancy Lopez. Jeremy, you go and tell me how it compared to Mexico City.
Okay. Here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst. Everything at the website, which will crash in a few seconds.
That's hereandnow.org.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.